This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakraborty. It's Friday and time for the Week in Review, starting with the passage of a sweeping criminal justice reform bill on Beacon Hill, the most comprehensive set of changes to the state's criminal laws in a generation. Here's Senate Judiciary Chairman Will Brownsberger.
It's soup to nuts, looks at the system from front to back. Every part of the system's been looked at with the goals of lifting people up, not instead of locking them up, with the goals of achieving justice. And I think what we've done working together is craft a bill that's extremely balanced.
And some of the state's district attorneys agree. Here's Middlesex DA Marion Ryan.
This is a very sweeping bill, and to have it in a place where it is pretty much agreement with where we are is a very significant step for the Commonwealth.
And at this point, the only wild card is Governor Charlie Baker.
I'm going to reserve comment on it until I actually get some feedback from my own folks about the bill in its entirety. There's a lot in it.
And there's a lot to talk about. And joining me to do so are this week's Week in Review panelists. Marie St. Fleur is a former Massachusetts state representative and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications. And we also just want to note she's a consultant at Community Resources for Justice that provides advice and strategy on community-based reentry services. Marie St. Fleur, it is great to see you at this table. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be here, Meghna. Thank you.
Also with us this week is Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and a regular contributor to WBU. Ars Cognoscenti. Tom, always great to have you as well.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
All right. So, Marie, let's just start with you. What's your first reaction to the passage of this huge criminal justice reform bill?
I think this was very good. It was very good for communities. I think that it went a long way. It still has a long way to go. Good for two reasons. One, it addressed some. It really kept the balance between safety, and it really looked at the issues of rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. And for many communities that have been over-policed, that have been over-criminalized, it allows an outlet in a pathway for rehabilitation.
Right. So let's hear a little bit more about that. For example, the bill encourages DAs to utilize diversion programs as alternatives to jail time. And Democratic State Senator Sonia Chang-Diaz says provisions like that in the bill will help rebuild communities that have really felt the impact of mass incarceration.
This bill represents a renewal for addicts who will be diverted to treatment rather than locked up, for children whose parents will come back sooner and with more dignity than they do today.
Tom, your take?
Finally. I mean, I'm delighted with this bill. It's funny. It passed almost unanimously,
right?
Both houses. And usually the kind of stuff that passes unanimously is just innocuous.
Only five votes against.
Only
in both
five
chambers.
Votes against. It's really quite incredible. And yet in this case, it really is. I think it says that we have experimented with things like mandatory sentences and found that they really don't work. They don't make us safer. And that, you know, the basic phenomenon is you put people in jail, you create criminals. You somehow get them out of jail, you put them in diversion programs, they can become productive members of society. That's what the focus is on this bill.
Right. So, Marie, let me ask you about that, mm-hmm. because as Tom rightly points out, the relaxing or even eliminating of some mandatory minimum sentences in Massachusetts is a major part mm-hmm. of this bill. And it really represents perhaps a long overdue change in the philosophy around criminal mm-hmm. justice in Massachusetts. But on the other hand, there are the introductions of some new mandatory minimums with things mm-hmm. like fentanyl mm-hmm. and carfentanil. So, I mean, I guess it makes me kind of wonder how much of a change there has been.
Well, I think there has been. I mean, I think, there's always a balance. On when you put together a bill like this, there are going to be, in some instances, winners and losers. But in this instance, overall, there's a release of the valve, particularly for people who have been continuously locked up. 72% of the folks who are in jail right now are in there because, particularly in Suffolk County, are in there because of some sort of substance abuse. There's an underlying substance abuse. We know that the criminalization and locking them up does not lead to bringing them back home so that they can become productive citizens. Yeah. So the fact that we have now reduced some of the mandatory minimum allowed for diversion programs is perfect. Fentanyl, it is troubling. I have to say, for those of us who are concerned about mandatory minimums, who believe that we have a justice system, that the purposes of our judiciary is to balance, is to provide that balance, it is disconcerting.
Yeah.
But I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, because there's always going to be things in it we like and things we don't like, but we've come the long way.
Yeah. Tom, do you have a thought on the fentanyl mandatory minimums?
So, I mean, I wish it weren't in there. I wish mandatory minimums weren't in there, period. And it is funny how people bit at that one, even as they're getting rid of mandatory minimums in another direction, as if they really can't make up their minds what the policy should be. Still, I would have voted for the bill overall. It's it's clearly an improvement. The problem with mandatory minimums is that it actually takes the discretion out of the hands of judges and kind of puts it in the hands of prosecutors.
That's correct.
Yeah. To that point, actually, I want to just shift gears and focus a little bit on juvenile justice and aspects of the reform bill that touch on that. Because if Governor Charlie Baker does sign the bill in its entirety in Massachusetts, there won't children under the age of 12 won't be able to be criminally charged anymore. They won't be touching the criminal justice system in that way. That's a major change. But on the other hand, retired federal judge Nancy Gertner was just with us yesterday on the show, and she said she was a little disappointed that the bill doesn't raise the age of the jurisdiction of juvenile courts to the age 19. And interestingly, she told me that she said on the federal bench, 80% of the cases that she dealt with teenagers in this age range. And she really feels like much more needs to be done. Much more needs to be done for 18 to 21-year-olds, but in the juvenile justice system.
We have to deal with that age group. It is, on the one hand, the age group whose problems are complicated on the one hand, but who, in fact, will grow out of those problems if we don't mess it up.
Yeah. Marie, do you have a thought about that?
Well, I agree with Judge Gertner that this is a population that we really need to take a look at. I understand that that particular part has been put to study. I guess there's a commission of some sort that's been established. Now, we know that if the advocates don't remain vigilant, that we will never actually see any action on that. But I agree with her, because if anybody's had an 18-year-old, you understand that that is a very immature time in their lives. They're developing emotionally. Their sense of self is developing. We also know that the brain science also confirms that this is a really tricky developmental period. And so locking them up for the rest of their lives, not providing a pathway for them to be truly rehabilitated, is not the best way to go.
Tom?
Yeah, I disagree. I think that, yes, 18 to 21-year-olds clearly are different than those who are more mature, but that doesn't mean you put them into the juvenile justice system. It means that judges have to have the discretion to understand what's going on in a person's life at that point. But, you know, an 18-year-old is an adult. I mean, the person can vote. If we're going to allow them to vote, I don't think that we should call them juveniles.
Interesting. Marie, did you want to respond to
that? Well, I have to say, I have three children, and I have to say at 18, having been blessed enough to see them all sort of matriculate through college, they still need a lot of supervision. They still need a lot of direction. And for me to think that they have the capacity to reason and make decisions, you're always telling them to make good choices and still trying to help them make good choices. And for those who have wonderful parents, wonderful support systems, they're going to continue to be directed in the right way. For those who actually even take a misstep and have those structures in place, they're going to be okay. But for a large population of young people who may not have them, then we're setting them up to be criminalized.
Okay, so this is interesting. I want to ask you about this because, I see both your points clearly, and I think it speaks to the sort of complex and changing way that we're looking at this period of young adulthood. But, I mean, Tom, it's like at certain points in time, for certain sectors of American society, we say at 18 they're adults. But at other sectors, we say they may not be adults. Like, to Tom's point, we're letting people vote at this age. If you're talking about making choices, that's a fundamental choice we're asking people to make.
Yeah, but if they're too immature to do that, then why let them do it?
You know, I think that being learning at a, I think from the very beginning, as a young person, you should be learning how to participate in our democracy. My six-year-old should begin to understand what her role and his responsibility is in that democracy. And maybe that's just from teaching her how to share. Maybe that's teaching you how to be that monitor in the classroom. I mean, and then it grows from there. So at 18, I actually think that, yes, you should be able to vote. You should be able to talk about what you'd like to see, because the world that's being created is really for you.
But
and
you,
so
shouldn't
you should
be able
to have some say in it. But what I am suggesting is that when you take a detour in life at 18 that you can't come back from, that is the distinction. And we need to be able to create a release valve for that young person to be able to be put back on the right path. And oftentimes, when you direct them right into the adult criminal justice system, you're really putting them on a trip to nowhere.
Right. And yet, kind of critically, once you become 18, in the eyes of the law, a parent has no more control over that child. That once the child is 18, I can't see that child's medical records unless the child gives consent. I can't tell the child when to come home or leave unless I just kick the child out or sort of, you know, force him. But we really do regard 18 as adulthood. And I take your point about, like, you know, drinking's 21 and things like that. There's some things we delay. But really, people are adults when they hit 18, and we regard them as independent.
But see, what Nancy Gertner told me yesterday was, and I think we sort of heard that in the cut that we played, is that this is also the age group that is most positively receptive to rehabilitative efforts. And if we put them in the adult criminal justice system, the chances of that go dramatically down.
Well, I mean, let's take a look at what this legislation's doing. What this legislation is trying to do is expand the number of diversion programs precisely for people who get caught up in the circumstances where maybe they weren't really cognizant of what they were doing. I think my objection here is not that we should be aware of the changes that kids young adults are going through, but rather that to put them in the juvenile justice system sends a very strong message that we do not regard them as adults.
Okay. Well, Maria, I'm going to give you one last hit at this, and then there's actually a question about the passage of the bill that I want to ask both of you. But did you want to respond here? Because this is really interesting.
I don't necessarily disagree with Tom on that, but it's a legal construct that we've created, right? But I think in every home that there's some distinctions being made there.
Okay. So that was really interesting, and I appreciate both of you engaging with me on that. There is one question about the ultimate fate of this bill that I want to ask you both, and that is, okay, Governor Baker hasn't yet said if he's going to sign it. Now, he has said, of course, that he and his office are going to look carefully through it, and as we heard him at the top of the hour saying, it's a really big bill. But Marie, what do you think is making him take pause on this?
Well, I don't know. There's an election cycle coming up. Maybe that might have some impact. I don't know. He does say that he hasn't had a chance to speak to his team, but I would presume, having been in the legislature, that there would have been conversations with members of the administration as this bill moved through the process. I'm certain that they would have had they would have been able to influence different segments of that bill. So I actually am not really clear as to why the holdback.
I just watched Donald Trump sign a budget bill that he had not read and did not know what was in it.
And said he would never do that again.
And said he would never do it. I think what Charlie Baker is probably doing here is the responsible thing of saying, well, maybe I should at least read it. Maybe I should at least talk to some people about it, see if anything slipped in the last minute that may be a problem. I assume that he's going to approve this, or if he doesn't approve it, we'll go back and ask for some small changes. But my assumption is that he'll eventually approve it.
Okay, good. So being a little methodical here in this case. I mean, it took us, 25 years to get here? What's another
couple of days?
All right. So let's move on to another major story of the week. And this is an area in which the governor has been extremely pointed. And it has to do with, of course, the state police. And on Monday, Governor Baker and State Police Colonel Karen Gilpin, the state police colonel, excuse me, it's Friday. You see what happens to my brand Friday? Colonel Gilpin announced plans to eliminate an entire state police troop, make major changes to oversight, audits, and perhaps the introduction of body cams for all troopers. And here's Governor Baker doing that announcement.
Restoring public trust to an agency that has so much day-to-day contact with the public once it's been bruised is not easy to do. The Mass State Police must follow through on these plans to reform how it operates and put the changes in place that will address the deficiencies that have been identified.
Okay, but the thing is that many of these reforms need to be negotiated at the bargaining table with the State Police Association. Dana Pullman is the president of the association. He wants more dialogue.
That's our utmost concern as Office of Safety. So if it does have a positive impact, that would be fine. But as a knee-jerk reaction to some 1% issue that we have in this department as far as perceived disciplinary or illegal actions, I want to make sure that this is exactly what is being done for Office of Safety.
Okay, so before I turn to my Week in Review panel here, I wanted to just apologize for stumbling over Colonel Gilpin's name earlier. She's State Police Colonel Carrie Gilpin. Okay, so your first response, Tom, to these state police possible changes.
I thought Baker's comment that once trust is lost, it's very difficult to restore is really an important point. Trust has really been lost here. And I'm not even sure that these reforms are going to be enough to restore that trust. But we have a state police at this point that over the last 6 months, it's been like scandal of the week. I mean, and it's just been extraordinary, from changes to arrest records to racist postings by state police officers to the bizarre, you know, overtime and so on at troop at F Troop and E Troop. I mean, this really is a body that seems to be deeply corrupt and deeply problematic. To then hear the pushback from that that these have to be negotiated over the table as part of a union contract really suggests that there's a lot of people within the state police department who do not get how serious these issues are.
Well, the pushback exists in part because these things do have to be negotiated, right? The body cams, for example. And it's something that that Colonel Gilpin actually did talk about, even as she talked about having the overall goal be to improve efficiency and accountability.
These changes will not happen overnight, but we view these reforms as a step in the right direction to strengthen and uphold our mission to serve and protect the public with the utmost integrity and dedication.
Marie, your thoughts?
Yeah, a couple of things. I think that, this is not the first time we've been at this stage with the state police. But what's important is that at this point, we have someone standing up and say they want to do something about it. And I have to give the governor, I mean, the fact that he came out swiftly and addressed it directly, I appreciated that. Those things do have to be negotiated. But what's going to be different right now is that there is continues to be active investigation by the press and by this new by Kelly Gilpin, because I think she brings a different level of she's not part of the club. Mm-hmm. She has actually someone who has experienced the violence in her life and came to this work because she truly wanted to make a difference based upon her own life experience. I think she brings a level of integrity in order to try to move this ship forward. I think we have to continue. I think the press, which actually have been really very helpful in bringing light to this issue, have to continue to be vigilant because the trust issue is clear. It's not simply around overtime. It's the fact that women are harassed. People of color don't feel a place in that space. And it is supposed to be a unit that's supposed to be about public safety for everyone.
Right.
And so we all should feel that we have a place at the table. And I say continue to shine a spotlight so we can move forward and really support the men and women who are doing a great job, mm-hmm. and then move out those who shouldn't be there anyway.
So before we run out of too much time, this is the law and order we can review this week, because I do want to get to one last big story that bubbled up just yesterday, and that is the fact that the Supreme Judicial Court has ordered the dismissal of more than 11,000 convictions in cases tainted by former state drug lab chemist Sonia Farrick. Now, if you'll recall, she pleaded guilty back in 2014 to stealing and using drugs from the state drug lab. She worked there for almost 9 years. And so, Tom, I mean, yet again, we have the throwing out of thousands of convictions based on just a terrible story out of the drug lab. Your thoughts?
So if you want to try to put a good cast on this, and it's hard to do that, the good cast is that eventually we get to a place where we recognize that process matters in criminal justice, and that if the process is tainted, then the conviction is tainted.
Right.
And that's what happened here. The process was tainted, and ultimately you saw DAs and the attorney general agree, and the courts end up agreeing, that because that process was tainted, we have to throw out the convictions. At least that speaks to an effort on the part of the system to try to clean itself up. I guess, obviously, the big question still out there is, this is the second in a row that we've had, you know, problems in terms of labs. Is there a deeper problem, or is it just an individual, a couple of individuals happen to be bad apples?
Well, I mean, to that question of is there a deeper problem, remember, bound up in all of this is also the fact that two former assistant attorney generals basically had committed fraud, deliberately concealing information and making misrepresentations in court about Farrick's misconduct, right? And, in some believe that their actions were in many ways more damning than what Farrick did. So, I mean, pick up on that, Marie. I mean, is it a few bad apples, or is it too much to say that maybe people should have broader concerns about the administration of justice in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts?
I mean, I think that overall that in Massachusetts, there's a lot of good work that gets done. But I think the issue of transparency and accountability, when we walk away and don't continue to stay focused on it, these are the results that we get. The fact that we are a nation of law, making certain that those institutions operate fairly is critical. And so in this instance, the fact there shouldn't be a question about those assistant DAs, honestly. Your job in that role is to mete out justice. That is, whether you're a district attorney, whether you're an assistant attorney general, it's not simply about locking people up. Part of your role, you're that link between the law and the public. And then, you know, giving people the relief, the society they relief their desires. And part of your ethical obligation is to mete out justice. And the fact that they would, it seems to me, just subvert the judicial system, it should be a no-brainer about what happens with those assistant DAs in my mind. And we need to do it swiftly so that we can, again, put trust in the justice system back on track.
Tom, any more thoughts, or is it time to turn to our hubbub?
No, I think there's sort of two models out there. One is you have prosecutors versus defense attorneys, and one tries to put people in jail and one tries to keep them out of jail. And you become enthusiastic as a prosecutor. You're just going to prosecute anything. A good DA, it seems to me, understands exactly what Maria just said, which is that the DA's job is not just to put people in jail, but rather to see what is proper justice out there. And plainly, that line was crossed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you both for today's Law & Order edition of The Week in Review. But let's end with something a little different. Let's end with our hubbubs. And those are the stories that maybe didn't make it to the top of the newscast or above the fold, as we might say. And Marie, you get to go first today.
Well, since we're going to move away from law enforcement, I'm going to think about one of the things that happened this week was the celebration of Massachusetts leading the way in education. I think, it was interesting to me that there was a celebration at the State House. It was a day after, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King, and we were celebrating the fact that Massachusetts is number one in education. Mm-hmm. But I think if Martin Luther King was to come back today and really look at the accomplishments, if we disaggregate the data and take a look at what's happening within many communities, I think he would find that for many of the communities that he was fighting for, that he died for, mm-hmm. that Massachusetts is only number one for some. And that to me is something that we need to keep an eye on as we celebrate that for many poor white kids, for many poor black kids, for many poor Latino kids, that we're not investing in them as we should. So I congratulate the new super Jeff Riley. Commissioner Jeff Riley, congratulations. But let's not forget that there's a lot more work to be done.
Absolutely. Tom Keene, your hubbub.
A little less serious. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh this week unveiled a slew of traffic-related ideas, increases in parking fines, new bus lanes, and most tellingly to me, reductions in the number of parking spaces and the creation of new pullover spots for Ubers, Lyfts, and taxis. More people than ever use hired cars, and the mayor's ideas should cut down on the congestion that occurs when one stops in the middle of a lane to pick up a passenger. But his ideas also speak to the future. 10 years from now, I expect, we'll live in a very different transportation world. Self-driving cars will be a reality. The number of privately owned vehicles will plummet. People will increasingly rely on autonomous cars instead of buses and subways. Those cars will need to pull over somewhere. And since autonomous cars don't need to park downtown, it makes sense that the lanes we now use for parking be turned into places for those pickups and drop-offs. Kudos to the mayor. There's no time like today to begin planning for tomorrow.
Tom, I did not ever peg you as a techno-utopian like that.
Oh, yeah.
Like that, like all of a sudden Boston's streets are going to be utterly free of congestion and traffic?
No parking, no congestion.
It's an amazing world. The autonomous vehicles gone bad.
Well, we do have to get over that issue.
Okay.
Right? That's why it's 10 years
all
from
right,
now
here,
and not tomorrow.
Here's to a hopeful vision for Boston's future. Now, see, Marie, this is your first time here, so you're going to see this is how it goes. Like usually, like the hubbub start off very high-minded and hopeful, and then I tend to like drag it down to the lowest common denominator, which I shall do. My hubbub is the fact that I'm a big fan of Dunkin' Donuts, and this week Oh, they might break me, okay? Because they have introduced donut fries.
Oh, stop!
They're testing donut fries. Look, here, I'm going to turn this computer around. That is what they look like. They look... They're like donuts shaped like French fries. And I'm sure they taste amazing. I haven't tried them yet. They're testing them as a side. Now, I mean, my passion for all baked goods aside, Twitter stepped in to remind us, dear Dunkin' Donuts fans, including Meghna Chakrabarty, churros. Dunkin' Donuts has just tried to reinvent churros. Mm.
There you go.
That's Twitter's
true.
Keeping That's it real. True. No That's cultural true. Appropriation
there
here.
You go.
That's my hubbub for the day. Marie St. Fleur, a former Massachusetts state rep and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications. Great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Meghna.
And Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and contributor to WBR's Cognoscenti page. Tom, always great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.